But he just has to be invited these days, or?
You know, I understand freshmen, but after a few months. Okay. We're going to have an informational hearing about TANF, so come on up.
I'm trying to confuse the chair.
That's why I realized. Sorry, I was in the wrong chair.
I'm better now.
Bill, did you want to come in? Go ahead.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Vic Todd. I'm the administrator for the self-sufficiency programs for the Children's, Adults, and Families Division of Department of Human Services. And with me is Dave Lida, the TANF program manager. And what we'd like to do is to use a letter that we have sent to the Ways and Means Committee to talk about what has happened since the session ended and House Bill 2469 was approved and signed by the governor. First, what I'd like to do is also mention that we have two district managers here today with us, John Radich from District 5, Lane County, and Jerry Burns from District 2, Multnomah County. And what we'd like to do is have them come up later in the presentation and talk about what their implementation has been like and what they're experiencing and so forth. This letter is laid out starting with background and then moves to an implementation update, and that is broken down into three categories around policy and rule implementation, training, and then talking more specifically about program updates. I'll be fairly brief in terms of the background since you worked this bill fairly hardly. But within 2469, there were major shifts with this program structure, and that included some significant philosophy changes. Starting off with it, what we did was to provide additional strengthening to the front side of this program so that we would have stronger assessments and evaluations going on. Increase the time that new parents would be exempted from participation after the birth of a child from 3 months to 6 months for a parent 20 years of age, and extended that to 4 months for teen parents. We modified the time limit rules from the what was the existing statute, created a new pre-SSI SSDI program for TANF eligible adults, created a post-TANF program that would provide a post-TANF payment for those that left due to earnings, also strengthened the client engagement, re-engagement process. As part of this, it was a major change. There were other programmatic changes that actually won't take effect until 2008 related to child support and medical assistance, as well as expansion of the educational opportunities that will also begin. Additionally, there was an expansion of the Family Support and Connections Program, as well as the addition of 16 intensive case consultants and 12 business managers to help with the workload in the field. So I'll pause momentarily there before we move to the implementation in case there are any questions.
Madam Chair.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you. Could you explain to me what business manager position entails? I think that's something that might not be well understood.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, Representative Cowan, the intent of putting these positions in place was really to enable the line managers, who are program managers, to stop doing the business functions of the branch so that they could focus on the program side and work more closely with case managers and so forth.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just on the hiring issues on the and good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for being here. On the intensive case consultants and the business managers, perhaps the SDA managers, when they come up, can talk about that, because I know some of the SDA service district areas have just recently hired their intensive case consultants. Others have already had hired them months ago. So there's been some ramp up, and depending on the district and maybe on the business manager positions as well. So they might be able to comment on how they're using those positions. That might be interesting.
Yes, we'll speak to that somewhat, but could expand on that. With the anticipated passage of the bill, we began to develop draft rules around the policy concepts in early July, and actually put out for public comment the temporary rules July 27th, and those were implemented October 1st, 2007, which was the implementation date for the House Bill 2469. It resulted in changing approximately 60 different rules and 40 sections of the policy manuals that staff use. It was a pretty large undertaking in that short time frame, but people stepped up to it. These temporary rules are currently being reviewed, and along with any changes for implementation of permanent rules March 1st. In this process, what we also did was to establish a TANF rule advisory committee, and that was made up of both internal staff as well as many different external partners, so that we could take a look at, before we actually get into the permanent process, rule process, we could kind of test this in terms of what we conceptually thought the direction is that we were going with these rules. And that process has worked very well. But it included people from the Center for Public Policy, Oregon Law Center, Food Bank, and many other people, folks from the Family Services Review Commission, and I know I'm leaving off some of the groups, but that's just to give you a flavor of that. In terms of training, what we did was to begin planning that training late in the spring in anticipation of the passage, and what we did was to provide 10 one-day sessions around the state, specifically focused on TANF, to begin that process of training staff in terms of what are the new provisions of this program. And in that training, what we did was to bring in not just staff, but bring in partners and advocacy folks to participate in that training. And we trained about 750 people in that process. And that went from July through August, or actually September, I think. Not last week of August. In this implementation phase, and we talked about it as we were doing the initial training, that we told folks that what we were going to do was look for areas where people were, struggling or having difficulty, and come back and continue to train on that. And so what we're in the process of doing right now is that additional training that we've begun in late January. And again, we'll do one-day sessions and train probably approximately 800 people in that process. And so we're really viewing this as a key element in kind of that ongoing shift, is to continually train folks, both in terms of what the program philosophy is, as well as how do you engage clients, how do you get clients to participate. So that's an ongoing process that will end in March, or the first week of March.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I think it's important for our listening audience out there to understand just basically that TANF was rewritten in the state because the federal government said, if you don't rewrite your laws, then we're going to take your money away. So, it is a major policy shift, and that our hand was forced, and hopefully what we've done is going to fix it. And Representative Kotek, quite frankly, was the lead, and because she knows this stuff, and it was her thing, and I participated in that, but, you know, I won't give her credit if it fails, because I'll share that.
Thank you.
I'll share that. But a concern is the training piece, that we can make, you know, grandiose claims up here that we're doing something, but if in the trenches they don't have the opportunity to fully understand what they're doing and why they're doing it, then it runs into a problem. And can you, one of the big changes was the re-engagement piece. And how long is the document that these workers are now having to look at in order to, the caseworkers, in order to determine the re-engagement? Is it, my understanding was something, it was some 18, 20 page long piece that was very difficult to follow.
Chair Tobey and Representative Maurer, for the record, my name is Dave Light. I'm the TANF Program Manager with the Department of Human Services, Children, Adult, and Families Division. I believe the document you're making reference to is a training document for staff. The initial feedback we've gotten on that document is very helpful. It contains a lot of pictures, you know, as far as screen prints and those kind of things, which I think extends its length considerably. And there are a number of steps we ask our staff to complete prior to actually imposing a sanction as we implement the 2469, just assuring that we get to willful noncompliance. And so there are a series of screenings that need to be taken into consideration, a series of we want to look at disabilities. We want to look at multiple attempts to re-engage, looking at the partner engagement in the staffings, looking at the child safety issues. And so it is through the life of a case, there are a number of steps.
All right. Thank you.
Chair Comey, if I can follow up that just sure. A little. Representative Maurer, I think that what you spoke to is probably the key, one of the key pieces here, and that there's a very large shift in this program, and it's a philosophical shift around why it is you engage these clients. And I think that's the message. We began to coin this term around engagement and re-engagement. And we were talking about the sanction process. And I think that in making that transition, it is difficult for folks coming off of years of the program that was there. And what we are trying to focus on is the concept around family stability, and that this is really about engaging clients, and that the sanction process is really a very small component, that we don't think that you accomplish anything if you get to a sanction, and so you want to be absolutely sure that that is the right next step. And so that's the messaging that we've been doing, is around that this is about engagement, and that we're more interested in are you engaging clients than are you pursuing a sanction. And so that's a transition in terms of that focus, but that's back to the training issue. So
okay.
That helps.
Thank you.
Just a quick clarification.
Yes, Representative Gilliam, right? Yeah, thank you.
This may or may not be the right clarification point, so if it's not, you can keep going. Thank you, Madam Chair. Numbers. How many clients, how many steps are at this point are you talking about in the implementation?
Chair Comey, Representative Gilliam, I'm not sure. Are you talking about the sanction process or the... I'm not quite sure I understand the question.
In the sanction process, are you addressing a specific number or group of clients?
Chair Comey, Representative Gilliam, yes. Currently, there's about 160 folks who are in the sanction process out of the roughly 9,000 mandatory.
160 out of 9,000.
Yes.
Thanks.
Oh, excuse me. It's about 10,000.
Thank you.
So we'll move on to the specific updates. We filed a fiscal 2008 state plan in October, and
I think people are wondering where you are.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm on page 4 now.
Thank you.
Both the jobs and family support and connection contracts are in place, and they reflect the new program design. In the first quarter, in terms of the family support and connections, the number of families that were engaged in that program was 576, and that compares to 342 last year during the quarter, October to December. So it's been a significant increase in that program, and we're looking to, for that to continue, frankly. The state family pre-SSI program, we worked, seems long and hard, with the Social Security Administration in getting an interim assistance authorization agreement in place. That is in place. We have 630 clients who have completed that interim assistance agreement, and we are beginning to see some dollars come back in as a result of that. They're small at this point, but it is beginning to show what we had hoped. The referrals are increasing every month. They seem to increase in January. Well, in October there were about 68 referrals. In January there were 194, and it looks like that trend is continuing. So while I would say this program is loading somewhat slower than we had anticipated when we developed the budget, it is beginning to ramp up, and so that's encouraging. The program manager, the disability liaisons, and the administrative assistants have all been hired. The manager, as well as the liaisons, are also participating in trainings with case management staff, helping them to understand the process. So it's evolving.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the, and I think we should all keep in mind this incredibly fast timeline to go from rules to ramping up and hiring for all the components. So I think, next time you come back with an update, we'll be even further down the path. What, could you describe the interim assistance authorization that you needed from the Social Security Administration? And I don't remember exactly what that was. And
Chair Tomei, Representative Kotek. What that was, or is the agreement that the client signs that once their eligibility has been determined by SSA, that the funds that we have expended with respect to that adult, we recoup. Okay. And so historically what had happened is that when the client was found eligible, the federal agency, because we were using TANF funds, SSA would contact us and find out how much assistance had been paid out, and then they would reduce the client's settlement by that amount. By having this, the way that this is being approached now as a state-only program, and we have this interim assistance agreement, then we are refunded that money, if you will. And so it creates an additional revenue source for us in terms of funding this program. So
thank you.
That's generally.
No, I had forgotten that we needed some kind of authority to switch how we were doing the payment schedule. And as we recall, having this program up to full speed is going to be important for meeting our work participation rates, because since this is a state-funded track, so to speak, we want to get as many eligible folks into that, so we're removing them from the counting we need to do for the rest of the caseload. So, but I'm guessing as you roll up with the more staff, you're going to see that your number's going to keep going up probably.
She brought up the work participation. Are you going to go into some detail about that?
Chair Comey, Representative Maurer, no. we can talk about that, obviously, but it's so early in the process.
Okay, it's early in the process, but I think it's to rehash it, because that really is a key in the federal funding piece is that we increase our work participation. And if we don't, then we run into, I mean, we're right back where we were, where they're knocking at the door saying, give us our money back. And
sure.
So I just want to make, is my understanding still correct? And do you feel like we're on the right track? Do we need to change directions, change tack, even at this early stage?
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, you're absolutely right. The participation issue is there. I do think we're on the right track. And I do think that we will have changes to make. And I think that as we talk about different resource sets and how we staff things, I think that all plays into this. But I think that we are on absolutely the right track with respect to focusing on helping families have outcomes. And employment is a key piece. There's no question about that. But I think it's a mix. And I think that's the challenge that Oregon's really faced with around implementing this program, is that, and we'll get to it later, but we have gotten now the final rules that were approved February 5th. And there is minor relaxation, but nothing I would call significant. And they don't take effect until next October. And so we are faced with a challenge, because they retain those very restrictive definitions around what activities are countable. So we are challenged to have the pre-SSI program be successful as well as the post-TANF, so that we can do a lot of these other things. Whereas historically we were really dependent on that caseload credit enabling Oregon to meet its rates.
One follow-up is, if you find between now and next February, because I don't think we pass the bill before February of 2009, do you have the ability to change your direction, at least to some degree, in this program by rule? Or are you bound, have we written it so that it's in statute and you don't have much flexibility in changing direction because you see the train wreck coming? I'm asking you to speculate, I guess, a little bit. But do you have some maneuver room in the law?
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, I think we do have some room. And I think that if we were looking at that, the process that we've used to this point is, inclusion and involvement. And so as we would move forward, and if we were seeing something that wasn't working and we thought that it needed to be changed, we would be bringing that before you and before other people to say, we need to do something. And so in some ways it might be a statute issue, in other ways it might be a philosophy discussion. But yes, I think that there's room there.
Okay. Well, I'm just going to, well, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, and I do think the work participation rates, it might make sense to have another report in the fall about how this is going. I mean, if we recall, I have this spreadsheet in my head about how we were going to get the work participation, every little component had to work right. We had to have so many folks coming into the pre-SSI, SSDI program. We needed a large ramp up into post-TANF, and I know we're going to get to that. And all these different ways of funding the different components, and so it's, I think we're going to have to keep an eye on all of them, because it was a, I know we're lower than 20, we're under 20% is my understanding on work participation, and we need to be to 50. So we have a long way to go. But it's a combination, I think, of resources and having each component work the way they're supposed to do, I think. For example, if we figure out we need more liaisons to get the SSI, SSDI track moving better, then we need to know that. When we get to the post-TANF, if we need different ways of approaching that, we have to talk about that. So,
but that it's the point. Suggest that perhaps we should have another meeting in the fall to see how this is going. Let me bring us up to date.
Moving to the, well, I don't want to skip over this next piece within the state pre-SSI, that we have established a formalized list of attorneys. 27 attorneys have asked to be added to that list, so that the clients that are in the pre-SSI program, if they want an attorney, can easily access that. So that's been very good. As far as post-TANF program, this program, as of January, we had a little over 2,300 former TANF clients that had been sent post-TANF notices, and 1,256 had received a post-TANF payment. So that program, they might disagree, but I think it's actually loading a little faster than what we had anticipated. So it's, you know, what this is saying to me is that these components are beginning to load, and as we get people in place, that these things are beginning to happen. So I'm feeling pretty good about where we're at this juncture. Not discounting the challenges that we have, but it does feel that we have accomplished a lot in this short window.
Madam Chairman. Thank you. And you can cut me off whenever you feel like. But the post-TANF program is probably where I have the most concerns. I went out and visited with some folks in my district at one of the jobs sites. And I think it's just the challenge is the public perception of the program. When people leave the program because of employment, our goal was to try to keep them engaged by getting the monthly stipend so we can count them towards work participation. But it's, I think, convincing those families to stay connected is challenging because of how the program has been perceived, you know, real or actual, whatever. And so I think the outreach on that end is going to have to be key, because if we don't get those numbers, we're in trouble. So, but I think that's probably the hardest piece of this that maybe none of us totally anticipated. I think Mr. Lightham, I think we had, I don't know what we anticipated at this point in the ramp up, but it might be good to see those numbers. We're anticipating, for example, 2,000, and we're at 1,200. I'm just wondering, you know, we have to hit certain targets by certain months, so.
Representative, could you tell us a little bit more about how the program is perceived post-TANF? What would be the problem in staying?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's just the fact that, you know, being on TANF is intensive. It's to some degree intrusive in that you have a lot of folks in your life, and you get a job, which is the goal of the jobs program for those who are job ready, and then you're just in the midst of your life and working and, you know, trying to get stable. And the idea of having to report or have to have those continual contacts might be not very, you know, people are like, I need to move on with my life. So having that continual contact with the department might not be at the top of their list. And so, and especially if they haven't had a good experience with a case manager in the past, or, you know, so I think it's a little bit of, we want folks to move on, but yet we need to keep them engaged to some degree so they can get the additional stipend. And so I think
even though they get the stipend, it's still not that much of an incentive that they would stay involved.
I don't think we've done the amount of outreach yet to make that shift for folks. And I don't know if you have any, and I don't know if the managers have any anecdotes of how it's going, but I think it's just more of, you want me to move on with my life, yet you still want to be connected to me, and why is that a benefit to me? Because folks are still having some medical and food stamps, so those benefits and child care are there. But if we need to get them that stipend and a little bit of engagement so we can count them, is my impression. So,
Manager? Could I ask someone to just elaborate a little bit more on that so we can count them piece? Help us remember what all of the details of that part.
Absolutely. And just briefly, we needed, because our income eligibility is so low here in the state, once someone works at more than minimum wage at half time, they make too much to be on TANF. Right. And if they're working, by giving them a little bit of, I believe these are TANF dollars or state dollars, I can't remember, but a little bit of extra help, we can say that they are still connected with TANF, and therefore they are working, not in our formal TANF program, but we can count them towards our work participation rates. We can say this segment of how we're helping through our TANF program is working, which is the idea of having this post-TANF versus a full cash grant that you would get at lower income levels. Does that make sense?
And so there are benefits to the state in having that.
Absolutely.
Explain that.
Yes. Well, maybe the...
Okay, maybe Vic could explain.
These are the experts. That
thank you.
Chair Tomei, Representative Kotek, Representative Cowan, members of the committee. I think there are several issues that Representative Kotek raised, and I'm not sure if I'll catch them all. But a couple of ones that she touched on really, to me, is an issue that Representative Maurer, you were speaking to, and that is changes. And one of the things that is, as we've moved into this and looked, we had a premise that we moved into post-TANF in terms of what type of reporting the client should be doing and so forth. And as we've moved into that, we've rethought that, and we're looking to see how do we simplify that so that it more minimizes what they have to do in that realm. The other thing that we are doing in this is trying to create a marketing piece around this in terms of trying to give this program a more positive outlook. And I think you have a copy of one of the brochures that we've developed. And we're actually developing brochures like this for each of these program elements so that staff have something to talk with clients about so that they can speak to an applicant about post-TANF and they can speak to the other components so that the applicant, the client, knows as they go through this process that when they actually close their TANF grant, there is some transitional services available to them, and that's really the intent of post-TANF, is to help these clients transition from not being employed to be able to sustain their employment. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of issues that go on in that transition, and that was really the intent of this when it's all said and done. So now I'm not sure which issues I didn't address.
Does the counting issue, I don't know if there's...
Well, I don't know that I could articulate it. I have a vague idea of what we need to do. But basically, I think what I was trying to pull out is that from a federal perspective, we need to have a certain percentage of people employed that are in the program. Or what is that? What are we trying to count? What we say, right. So we can count them. What do we need to count? That's what I'm trying to...
One of the challenges of the new federal regulations is that they redefined what counted as work. And some of that's paid employment, some of that's subsidized employment, some of it is certain types of work activities. And because that definition got narrowed, it was either we were going to have this huge subsidized employment program, which would have been very cost prohibitive, or we tried to work with folks who had already gone into the paid employment realm, i.e. the post-TANF population, and by giving them some transitional support, we would be able to count their work activities, in this case paid work, into our work participation rate overall.
That's what I'm trying to pull out is the reason we're doing this in terms of meeting federal requirements as well. Besides that, I think transitional services are a good idea. Don't get me wrong.
An opportunity in the midst of a federal mandate. So, continue.
Thank you.
The next piece is really related to House Bill 2469. Directed us to report back to the Family Services Review Commission every 6 months around the sanction process. And so as we began to talk about this in the spring in terms of what would we do in terms of an initial report, given that the program would have been essentially operational 1 month, we settled on that we were going to do a review of all of the current sanctions under the old process and take a hard look at those in terms of, when we transition from the old process to the new process, we wanted to be sure that folks who were sanctioned should be in that place. And so what we did was actually the field conducted this review, and it was a pretty major effort. And we found out a lot about, what we weren't doing correctly. And it wasn't so much that, a lot of these clients should not have been sanctioned under the old process as much as it was that there wasn't sufficient documentation often in the case record. And so we were really trying to use this process as a means to engage those clients who were in a sanctioned status so that it would cause a new contact to occur. And so in this process we were putting out to the clients that if they would come in and ultimately do a new plan, that we would lift that the sanction and they would start fresh. So it was really trying more towards, move towards getting clients to come in, because it kind of goes back to that discussion we were having earlier around sanctions and what does that actually accomplish. But what we found in that process was that there was need for, you know, improved documentation in terms of what the case manager actually includes in their case record, so that someone can come back and look and say, yes, this does meet the criteria. As well as, again, back to the training issue in terms of ensuring that people are applying policy correctly. So as we talk about in this letter, you know, this is an ongoing piece. It gets a lot of discussion in terms of that transition between the old philosophy and the new philosophy, and what does that mean, and how do I change what it is I do. And this, actually the focus of the training that we're doing now is around client engagement, and how do you apply the strength-based model that we're using, that's that we're using the Dr. Ford model around that. The additional staff that we got coming out of the session, again, most of the intensive case consultants have been hired. And should all be hired by the end of February. The business managers have also been hired and been placed, and you know, the feedback I'm getting from program managers and said branch managers, but line managers, you know, is very positive. They're talking about that they are, you know, these people are picking up these business functions, and that's opening up the line managers to actually be doing more work with case managers. That's probably oversimplification, but that's really what the intent was, and that's what it's come back to us as, is that this is being viewed very positively. So we're going to be looking at that as we go forward in terms of, you know, what do we do with that concept, you know, as we look at resources.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I don't know if Representative Maurer wants to comment on this too, but we had a conference call with the district manager and the program manager in Jackson, Josephine County, talking about they had just hired their intensive case consultant, and their goal was to do a lot of one-on-one training, having that person sit in on interviews and to help, you know, with that that additional specialized training, seeing how the new program is working. So I felt really positive about what their plans were, and I think it would be good to hear how this is working when you come back in the fall. Obviously a hiring timeline here to get this rolling, but I think that's going to help with some of the training issues. The problem is we allocated 16 intensive case consultants. I believe they've been divvied up one per service district area. Is that correct?
Chair Tomei, Representative Kotek, that's approximately correct.
And when you have the size of a service district area such as Multnomah County, having one versus, you know, so I think we might have to look at, do we need a few more of those if they are indeed working the way they are, and they seem like a good thing. So,
thank you, Representative
Kotek. All right. The next item refers to ongoing reporting, and that really is the requirement that we report to the Family Services Review Commission on, you know, every 6 months. We actually meet with them every month, and so, I mean, we are reporting and talking about issues as an ongoing basis, but we've set up, you know, this every 6 month reporting as well. As we do that, of course, we're developing and talking about what areas do we need more effort in, and so forth as we go forward. And one of Representative Kotek's questions was around what are we looking at going forward for the 2009-11. Budget development. And at this point, we have developed policy concepts internally and have shared those with several groups, the Family Services Review Commission, the Child Care Commission, and others. And if the committee's interested, we would be happy to provide a copy of that to you as well. But we are looking at many of the issues that we talked about during the last session around eligibility levels and payment levels, as well as, you know, many other areas, but they are still just concepts. They haven't really even been vetted fully through the Children, Adults, and Families Division, let alone the department, and so forth. So, but it is trying to have that conversation about, you know, what are the next steps and what things do we do in this program. The last piece is, and I think I've already mentioned this, that but I like this time frame, the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005, signed in 2006, and we had final February of 2006. We had interim rules in June of 2006, and then really last week we have the final rule. And so we'll continue to work that. The final rules don't actually take effect until October of 2008. At one point we thought that when the final rules had come out that we would be able to make some modifications, but actually that's not going to be possible because of their effective date, it appears. And finally, in summary, I think it is real critical that the legislature and the governor have taken this program where they've taken it, and it says a lot in terms of what we are viewing as kind of critical issues going forward for these families. And so we're going to continue to work with the various partners, with you as partner, and try to continue to improve this. So.
Great, thank you.
So,
any other questions?
Madam Chair, I have a couple of questions and comments, but do you want me to hold them?
Let's do. Let's do hold them. Go ahead.
So at this point, I would have the district managers come up and speak to you about what they've experienced.
Thank you. These two left. Do you want to direct this to the district managers?
They might need to come up on some of these, but
okay.
But since these two are here, maybe
let's hear from them. Right. Okay. I also want to point out that we did get in our emails the final TANF rules dated February 5th. And could you state your names, please, for the record, and also spell them for our lovely secretary.
Yeah, Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I'm John Radich, R-A-D-I-C-H. I'm the district manager from Lane County.
Thank you, John.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jerry Burns, B-U-R-N-S, Multnomah County.
Thank you, Jerry.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, first of all, I'd like to really thank you for this TANF changes and enhancements. What I hear from community partners and clients that it's a very positive approach to their lives and helping them move forward. So that's what I hear in Lane County. It's people view it as one of the better things we've done in a number of years for our low-income citizens who struggle day to day. So I want to thank you for that. I'll go through some of the points, listening to the previous conversations and questions to try to fill you in about the implementation. Overall, I'd say in my district it's like anything. You have the base program that we've had, then you have some changes and enhancements, and it's like any time when those things occur, there is some starts and misstarts, and I think workers are trying to do the old plus the new, and then have to kind of relearn some new things, and so you kind of get into that mix of things. But I do believe we're making very good progress. And I think staff are coming along. They're understanding the terminology and the philosophy. And so I think, you know, 4 months into it, I really believe that we're on the right track. And I think things will improve even more from where we are today. On the particular programs, the post-TANF program, we've got two-thirds of our people who went to work who went over income have agreed to participate in the post-TANF program. And what a number of years ago, we had an MDRC project that we ran for 5 years on
MDRC
Manpower Development Research Corporation, a five-year pilot about post-TANF services. And we kind of used what we learned from that pilot And so we do have a couple staff that try to engage clients as they leave. And what we're really trying to do is make sure that their ability, because sometimes when you have, you know, obviously most of our families are single adult with children, and juggling childcare, transportation, getting acclimated to work culture, things like that. We try to assist them in that. And we also try to point them into directions around resources, again, around, you know, say, workforce pieces with the WIA, Workforce Investment Act partners. So we try to provide that. And I think the key thing, though, for us in the post-TANF is really starting from the start and really marketing what we can, you know, that program from this, when they first apply for TANF and throughout our TANF and jobs program. And so then really it's really about building relationships with that client. And we find that in the NDRC pilot and with our current efforts, 55-65% of the clients still want some contact and assistance. And then, you know, as they gain their ability to deal with issues every day, that, you know, then it tails off, but we're trying to, you know, offer that and assist them so that they are successful in that transition. And so I think we're on a good start there, and I think our other goal too is to try to, once they get employed, try to keep them employed, so if there's issues around childcare and raising their children and getting to work and some issues at work, we try to problem solve with them so that they can be successful and retain that job. Because I think, you know, if you, it's like anybody else, once they're successful and they build their self-esteem, it kind of helps them, helps their family, and it's very positive for them. So I think that program is going very well. The other program, the pre-SSI clients, really the ones that are, we have about 70 clients that are in that program, very appreciative. I think basically instead of feeling like they had to do something for their grant, and because of their disabilities, they really cannot, and their pretty high chance of getting SSI, they really appreciate the help of that program, somebody, a disability analyst, assisting them through the SSI process so they can, you know, become hopefully, you know, approved for SSI, and I think that's a benefit for them with their disabilities. So that's been very positive. I think the challenges in that program are more of the areas. We have a lot of our clients have multiple issues, and sometimes you don't know if it's environmental or what, but it's the grayer areas where you have disabilities and what's the right path. I've seen in the past some clients, if they can have something positive go on in their lives and they're successful in something, a lot of times a lot of their issues, you know, they can be successful in work or something else. And other ones really cannot because of the multitude of issues. And I think that's the challenge, is how do you evaluate and measure that. And I think that's one of those things, as we load the program, it's going to be one of the challenges. And I do think we mentioned the intensive
I'm going to stop you just for a minute, because I think Representative Gilson has a question.
I did. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the presentation. You had mentioned moving folks with disabilities onto SSI, and this was an issue that I raised when we had the TANF discussion last session. One of the concerns I have is that people with disabilities have the highest unemployment rate of any other sector of society, and it isn't because they can't work. It's because we often have very low expectations and don't provide appropriate supports and training. In addition to getting folks on SSI, which if they're there, they'll be in poverty forever, what kinds of training opportunities and supports are you providing to people with disabilities to help them get appropriate placements in the workforce so that they can be independent and self-sufficient?
Okay, Chair Tomei and Representative Gelzer. In Lane County, we're very lucky. We have a good relationship with Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services, the state office, and so we get some of our clients are connected with OVRS. We also have contracts in our jobs program with Goodwill and St. Vincent de Paul in Eugene, and they run a multiple type of sheltered programs where actually they're producing a product. St. Vincent de Paul recycles all kinds of materials, and then they sell that on the market to fund their operations. And Goodwill does the same thing around the retail sales of clothing and stuff. And what they do, for years, both organizations have had contracts not only with us but with Disability Services and the Senior Disabled Services organization. organizations to work with people with disabilities. And so I think we do have some resources for the training and people who have a long-term history in that. Is it enough? I don't think it is because there are some challenges in that, but we do have some services that we, have people access who want to go down that, a track of becoming employed.
Can I follow up with two? I guess the two questions, does the individual have to take the initiative to say they want to go down that track to work, or is there a proactive encouragement that all people can work and that, a job brings us a tremendous amount of dignity when we do that? And then the other question is, are there opportunities beyond the sheltered workshop type of environment to help support these folks to, be out in the community and more mainstream types of jobs?
Representative Tomei and Representative Gelser, I don't think there's enough resources. I think in our program we try to sit down and work with the individual and talk about the opportunities and pros and cons. And I think we do try to encourage people who are, young, who have disabilities to, try to attempt something in the work or training and through these sheltered workshops or something to test it out and see if they can do that. It's one of those things that I wish we could do more, but I do think we do try to assess that. We don't try to just say because you have some disabilities you can't work. We do try to talk about that there's other things people can do, and sometimes you can work part-time and still get your disability payments, and there's different ways that people can balance the work and their disability in their personal life. So we do try to explore that and use OVRS and other services to help them through that decision making.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. And I think this is an important point, and I think it's that early engagement and relationship building with the client to help them figure out what makes the most sense for them. In fact, there were some concerns early on with some of the rules that we were being too restrictive of who was being allowed to apply for that track. So I think it's a balance of being clear about what the options are and working with individuals. But, this could be a discussion with vocational rehabilitation about what they need maybe. I heard a lot of the department or a lot of the offices have vocational nurses, and so there's that expertise that's being placed in the offices as well in terms of the assessment part. But I think we're still working out the kinks. But I think, again, it's that initial assessment and not trying to pigeonhole folks, but just, and that goes for any of these options in the program, I think.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee. The other things on the positions, and I think associated with the pre-SSI and other activities, the re-engagement, the intensive case coordinators, ours will just be starting this Wednesday, so it's actually tomorrow. And we're looking forward to that because I think that will help workers as they do the staffings. We do weekly staffings and hopefully to kind of assess people's strengths and weaknesses and what issues are facing them and come up with a plan that's realistic and sit down with the client and, have them also tell us what they need to be successful, and we can build that plan. So we're really looking forward to that. Those intensive case coordinators also, we plan on using them during our staffings, so that way it allows them to kind of coach and mentor staff through areas, and they'll have a level of expertise that's greater than a lot of our staff people have. And so I think it'll help raise the awareness and knowledge of our staff that we have. The other one with the office manager, business manager, we hired one. She decided that, it's unfortunate for us, she was very good, but she decided that management was not for her, and so she went back to her represented position, and we just hired another person, and so that was, she started 2 weeks ago, but we're looking forward to separating some of the business functions from the program and giving the line managers more time to spend with the program staff to coach, mentor, and oversee the program and help with the implementation and all the issues that come when you're working with people who have multiple issues, and we all have different perspectives to try to kind of work it so it matches what the program's intent is. The other program I just want to mention briefly is the Family Support and Connections. Locally, we've increased our referrals a lot. we've gotten some staff from Catholic Community Services. We have a contract where they actually go out and visit with our clients, and they stop by our offices. And we've also integrated that program with funding that comes from the Commission on Children and Families in Lane County, the old safety net. So we kind of combine those. And the goal there is really to kind of prevent those children on TANF from crossing over sometime in their life into a child welfare and foster care. And I think that has, I'd say our referrals and our connections has increased dramatically. And in that program, I think we just, what we're trying to do is connect those families to community resources that are available in Lane County to try to help them out and reduce some of the stress and pressure that they have when raising a child based on being in a poverty and things they're facing. So I think the referrals are up, and now we have to kind of work on the quality piece there. I think the other challenge on the implementation, and Vic and Dave mentioned the training staff, we're going through these sessions of training, but it's also getting those intensive case coordinators on board and the philosophy out there. I think a lot of times we train our staff to do things, and they're used to doing it. And it's like anything, you have to kind of, it's not like we're training, tell them to do things 180 degrees different, but we're trying to shift it. Maybe it's 45 degrees. We're trying to shift their how they approach things. And it is a different mindset to try to engage clients. And I think our workers all claim they were doing strength-based processes, but sometimes they weren't as engaging with the client as I think we would have liked. And I think this, what we're trying to do now is really to move more towards that engagement. And sometimes I think workers still think there's a win-lose. And I still hear that if they get to, if a client's not being successful and they're trying to help them through, and they feel like as if, they failed, and that, and instead they should try to find, how can they go back and talk to that client, find out why it failed, and what would the client recommend, to do differently? And is there some other way of approaching it so we can make that client, successful? And I think that's kind of a, it's a work in progress, and I think that's one of the challenges. And I think training and experience and the support they'll get from these intensive case coordinators and their line managers is, I think, crucial in that. And that's one of those things where it's a work in progress. And I think that's, unless you have questions of me.
Thank you, John. Mm-hmm. All right, Jerry.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll take a slightly different approach to this in terms of implementation. About a year ago, we met with contractors, line staff, shop stewards, and our managers to talk about how the program was going and how people were feeling. And there was an incredible level of frustration. People felt like the workload was too great, the relationships were strained, the traffic that was coming into the branches was far too great, and it was just overwhelming. And so we went through a number of meetings and talked about sort of redesigning, restructuring the program in Multnomah County, and we did. And what we did was we separated the eligibility function from the jobs case management function, so that instead of having 60 case managers who were doing both eligibility and jobs, we had 25 that did nothing but jobs, 100% of their time on jobs, and 35 who did eligibility. Then we took the 25 who were doing the jobs case management and located them with the jobs contractors, which in many districts they've done. We didn't have that opportunity in the past. And then we created a number of committees to begin trying to deal with other issues, traffic being one of those. That we did a conservative count, and it came to something in a neighborhood of 500,000 people a year coming through our offices. Duplicated number, but that's conservative. So it was really trying to begin dealing with those. And we put that in place now, and it's, like anything, it has kind of good news and bad news. On the challenge side, I think that one of the issues that is we now have two workers for each client. That's very confusing. And so folks aren't sure which worker they're supposed to talk to about what. It's a piece that we've got to work on. That when we put this in place, we had about a third of our workers who actually, through the process we went following the bargaining agreement, actually moved to another location. I mean, they chose the job they wanted based on seniority. So we had all of the staff moves and the settling in process that needed to occur. Traffic and dealing with an increase in, you know, intakes continues to be a problem for us. And then overall, I think there's just a part of this about, this is, as folks here have been saying, this is such a profound change. It's a really, it's a big cultural shift, both for our workers and for our clients, that our workers tended to look at the work they were doing in very black and white terms. You're either eligible, you're not eligible. You do this, you don't do this, and I'll make, you know, I make my decisions on that basis. And now we're trying to take, you know, a more holistic approach, a social work approach, something that's about relationships. That is a major shift for many of our staff, not all, but for many. And it's a major shift for our clients who looked at our organization as one who followed these prescriptions of black and white eligibility determinations. So we've got those challenges. On the positive side, we have 25 case managers who spend 100% of their time doing jobs work. Their relationship with clients has improved dramatically. Their knowledge of client situations has improved. Their relationship with contractors has improved. That there are regular opportunities where they are talking with one another, contractors and our staff, about how to work with clients, how to deal with, do problem solving. And we've seen improvements in our performance, and we have an increase in job placements, an increase in wage at placement. We're, you know, kind of catching up on, as everybody else is, with loading other components. In terms of the intensive care consultants, I'd say that we've hired, we actually will have four in Multnomah County, and they'll start later this month. And our thinking is that these are really the folks who need to help us with the shift in terms of culture from eligibility to social work. And I mean, for example, one of the things that we're finding is that with our jobs case managers, that my conversations with them, that one of those things that they express a lot of frustration about is re-engagement. We only have 50 clients that we're working with in that regard, but they're very frustrated about it. And my sense of that is that they're still focused on the old eligibility kind of mindset, and what they really need to do is to shift to saying, we have a lot of clients that, in fact, have a lot of other issues and challenges and opportunities and motivation. Let's put our energy there. And I think the intensive case consultants are the folks who help them do that shift, that do the, go through the staffing with them and get, you know, let's look at this differently. The business managers will have two in Multnomah County, and our thinking about those is really, it is about helping us with that pilot testing around how we deal with traffic. We've done some pilot tests around reorganizing how we approach the work so that we can reduce the number of clients who have to come to the office, and we can decrease the amount of time they have to spend when they do come. So we've tried some stuff around, at first we were calling it sudden service. It seems to be closer to same-day service, so that at least people don't have to come back again. They can have an appointment if they like, if they for another day or later in that day. But it's really about trying to direct people so that they don't have to come to the office yet again. They come once and get forms and then fill them out and come back again. We want them to fill out the forms and see the person today. So I expect that our business managers are really going to focus on that traffic piece. I think, you know, the comment I'd make about post-TANF is we had experience with this in the past, and I do think that it is one of those where the clients seem like they fall into sort of three groups. There's that group that says, for whatever reason, I never want to see you again. Whether it was a bad relationship, it was their own perception about how you feel about being on welfare. there's that group that never want to leave home, that I've got a relationship. I want you to stay with me, and I'll stay in contact to help me with issues. And I think there's a third group that says, I'll call you when I need you. And, you know, we're at this point where what we've got to do is we're working on much more positive marketing at the time that clients get a job, about what it is we have to offer. And we're working on packets that we can provide to clients when we do home visits. But really the key is going to be whether we've established a relationship with them before they got the job. And if we've got a relationship, then it will be likely that we can follow up with them, and the post-TANF numbers will go up dramatically. So that's kind of a quick overview of what we're doing in Portland.
500,000 clients. It's just mind-boggling.
Madam Chair, it was startling, because we'd never actually sat down to count. And we have one small branch that is downtown, that's our New Market branch on just off of Burnside, and it deals primarily with the homeless population. And they actually started this, and what they found, they did a count 1 month, and they had 8,000 clients come in a month. And it's a little tiny office. It's a place for people to come. And there's a part of it where when we began looking at the issue of clients coming into our office and why they came in, some clients come in not because they need anything, because they have nowhere else to go. It's a place where they know people, they either know other clients or they know workers, and it's an excuse. It's an excuse to get out and be among people. It was startling, and then we began looking at the numbers in the other offices, and that's on the low side.
And when you say that my math is correct, that's 400 a day. 400 a day in a small office. Are you as lonely as I am?
Yeah, it brings a question to mind Thank you.
I'm sure. First of all, I want to understand when you say a chance for clients to be among people, is that what you meant?
Madam Chair, Representative Gillum, that's what I meant.
Okay.
Follow up? You say that the key is establishing relationship. So that's sort of staggering when you think of staff versus 400 a day. So would the most important thing be the efficiency of a new model, one maybe not quick, but one day service? Would the key be the training, or would the key be the ratio of your staff to clients? Maybe that answers all of the above, but I wonder what your response would be.
Madam Chair, Representative Gillum, part of this is that we have clients who come in for food stamps, for medical assistance, for TANF, for daycare, and while it would be nice to have a relationship with all of those, that, you know, for purposes of this program, it's really the TANF clients, which is really predominantly families with children and those who are unemployed. And for those, that it is in many ways about coming up with more efficient processes for those who are simply getting food stamps and who aren't seeking a relationship or other services from us, so that in fact you can spend more time with those for whom you're trying to do a complete assessment about what their needs and issues are and how to provide services.
Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, one of the things that I think another opportunity with the TANF redesign is a new opportunity to look at how the reporting periods work in our different programs. We worked for years to simplify reporting in food stamps, for example, so we could eliminate the number of times somebody has to come to the office. We've tried processing centers, which would be once you were on, you would have someone you'd have to report your changes to, but you wouldn't have to come in the office. We've put health plan eligibility back at the district offices. I'm sure it has increased workload, and I'm not sure we want to shift back to a different way to do that. But, you know, is employment-related daycare and TANF and food stamps, can we get them all on the same reporting cycle? So if you are a family on all of those programs, you're not trying to come in at different times of the year to bring in your numbers. So, I mean, I know we've had some discussion about this, about reporting periods in the post-TANF program. wanting to match them up with the ERDC, employment-related daycare, is currently at 10 days or something. Well, why not expand it to 3 months or 4 months for both programs so people don't have to come back in? So I think I'm hoping the McKinsey consultants who are looking at processes within the department will look at some of the quality improvement process around. Can we simplify some of these processes, not only for the benefit of customers, but straight out workload in the offices? So I think we're at a very interesting point in how you deliver services. Now with the TANF changes, I think we have an opportunity to relook at some of these things, fortunately.
Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen. You've got an incredible job. We appreciate all that it's taking from you and the staff. And please give our good wishes to your staff, who I know must be working extremely hard. Thank you. And change is hard. Thank you. We have other people in the audience. I know it's not a public hearing, but if anybody has anything they would like to add to this, since we have time, we'd be glad to hear from them. John.
Oh, anybody but him.
Oh, anybody.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. And I wanted to just make a couple of comments since we have the opportunity to talk this morning. And first of all, I want to thank the whole committee for the work that was done during the last session. I think it definitely is among the highlights of the bills that were passed relating to human services last session. And I appreciated the opportunity to work on 2469 along with Representative Maurer and Representative Kotek on the work group. And that was very, very helpful to work on that process. And I really want to, again, thank Representative Kotek for her leadership prior to the session about really developing what turned out to be, what you heard this morning, a really pretty significant change in philosophy. And I think that has really been embodied in the bill. And the challenge to the department will continue to be how to implement that philosophy, how to make it work. The Oregon Law Center offices and legal aid offices around the state have regular direct involvement with clients on the local level. And sometimes there are questions that arise. And the department, by and large, has been responsive to these issues, but it will be something that we will want to have ongoing discussion with the department about, and we'll all be looking forward to the implementation of 2469. As I said all along, we definitely want to see the department succeed because we want to see the clients succeed.
Thank you, John. And just for the good of the order, let us know what your job was in your previous life.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I was the director of Clackamas County Social Services, and one thing that I would mention since you gave me that opportunity is that a bill that did not make it last session on general assistance is something that we were very concerned about in Clackamas County when that program came to an end. And I think that thanks to the efforts of Representative Cowan, general assistance is in Senate Bill 1061. And I think there'll be an opportunity in the 2009 session to compare what happens with that SSI, SSDI track for TANF clients, and then what will happen as far as individuals and couples that don't have children, about whether we'll take that step with helping to make it possible for those people to get federal benefits as well.
We talked about that at length during the last session. I think there was a lot of support for that in this committee. It just had a big price tag, which is only going to get bigger, so that's a scary prospect. Any questions of this witness? Thank you so much, John. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak before? Okay. Marcia.
Marcia Kelly, the American Association of University Women of Oregon Public Policy Committee. One of the exciting things that happened to me on Friday was opening my email and finding our association Friday alert talking about the federal regulations in TANF and tweaking just a little bit the educational opportunities. And I'm hoping that the department takes a very creative look at how we can help clients who may need education at a community college or college level whether maybe we can be very creative and run it sequentially with our individual program and really help some of our clients in their educational endeavors, because we know that the higher you attain education, the better it is for not only your family, but for the state, for the taxes that come back in payroll taxes. So that was just something that I wanted to put on record. Let's be creative in how we look at those educational tweaks that the feds are going to let us do.
Thank you so much, Marcia. Thank you.
Great point.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Marcia brought up the post-secondary education issue. So one of the things that we did in the bill was have restarted that conversation about post-secondary education as an allowable work activity. Some of the new rules will go into effect October 1, and so we're working with the department to form a work group to look at what we're doing now. We have a program called Degree Completion Initiative where up to 12 months you can be on a TANF grant and be engaged in a degree program, looking to expand that a little bit, looking at the new regs, looking at how we provide a continuum of education from GED to VOC, vocational, technical, up through 2 and 4 year degrees for a small part of our caseload that has the interest and the ability. There will be resource issues, of course, but we're looking forward to that conversation as we develop the rules to implement in October 1. So we'll have a report back on that probably back in the fall, too. So.
Terrific. Thank you, Representative. Any other comments, questions?
I'm sorry.
Yes. Go ahead.
Thank you. I just wanted to comment on the disqualification report since we didn't really have any comment on that. I want to, first of all, thank the department for doing the six-month review. I think it was telling in part of the philosophical shift and how we do our work around disqualifications and sanctions. We spent a lot of time talking about the sanction policy when we tried to craft the bill. I think the corrective actions that the department have taken are the right steps, looking at how we do the reporting, how we do the documentation, the wanting to re-engage and keeping engaging a client before we have to go to the final step, which is a sanction. And I know some folks felt a little, I saw these numbers and I was shocked but not terribly surprised, I think, because I think we've had a policy of maybe sanctioning before asking certain questions, and now I think we're turning the page and doing something a little differently, and I think the forms and everything you've developed I think will help, so that in 6 months when we see your next report, I suspect it's going to look considerably different. And I know that's how you want it. And I just want to thank you for being so thorough in getting us that report and sharing it with the whole committee and the Family Services Review Commission. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming, all of you. We do not have a meeting tomorrow. Or or Thursday. We may be getting bills that we may have to hear on Friday. We're not sure. If not, I'll try to set up. Friday we've got seniors. So that was our intent to have to hear the bill that several of you have been working on and the seniors committee. And we may be having to hear some Senate bills that are coming over, so we may have to do both.
Madam Chair, that specific bill that we've talked about before will be up in the Senate committee today and is anticipated to move. So I don't know exactly what the where it will be in the process, but because we have a number of senior advocates and seniors who expect to be in the building on Friday, I would look forward to an opportunity to just sort of update the committee on where we are with that whole thing after it finishes whatever is happening to it in the Senate committee today. And I would direct folks to the article in today's Oregonian that addresses the issue around assisted living facilities and rates. And I think that we're well positioned to reassure the public that we are have been planning for some time to respond to what's come up in today's newspaper.
Good. I haven't seen the paper yet, but I'll look for that. Great. Did I forget anything? Okay. I close the House Committee on Human Services and Women's Wellness. Thank you for being